You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily Giles.
I'm going to start my birth stories now. I'm just going to read the original birth stories that I wrote at the time. I'm really disappointed. When I wrote my son's, my first birth story, I wrote it with all the details, and then I thought, oh, this is way too long, so I must have cut out about two-thirds of it. And now I don't remember all those extra details, and I wish I'd kept the length. I'll just start by reading his. My husband and I are from New Zealand. We always wanted to travel, so we had spent years saving up enough to see the world. On the 20th of March 2013, we bought our VW camper in Holland, the Netherlands, with the intention of travelling all around Europe for a year. This birth story fast forwards exactly 3 years to the day later when our firstborn, who happens to have been conceived on our wedding night in Fiji of 2015, arrived into the world. A peaceful free birth on our Portuguese farm. When we first learnt we were expecting, we were still living in our VW camper with our Labrador and we're in the process of looking for a farm to buy to live sustainably. We bought our farm in November, and then a month before the birth, family members gifted us a caravan to live in. And a week before our baby was born, the exterior build work on our future farmhouse was complete. I say all of this to set the scene. We do not currently live traditionally with electricity, running water, or heating. Saturday, the 19th of March, I was 38 weeks, 6 days along, exhausted and emotional from experiencing what I thought was over 12 hours of Braxton Hicks. Around 7 p.m. that night, I noticed the contractions getting stronger to the point where I was actually able to distinguish when they started and stopped. I wondered if our baby was going to make an early appearance than expected and laid everything out for the birth. My husband saw that I'd set everything up and asked if the baby was coming. I said, I'm not sure yet, but just in case. Around 9 p.m., we decided to snuggle up in bed and watch a movie while I started to time the contractions. I was quite confused as to my progression because they were very irregular, 20 to 70 seconds long and anywhere from 1 to 7 minutes apart. Since I had no idea how I was progressing, we decided to go to sleep after the movie. I think I managed to doze 2 or 3 times between contractions before I eventually woke him up, not long after 1 a.m, and asked him to start filling the pool. You know, for us, this was not as simple as just turning on a tap. He headed out in the dark, rainy night to turn on the generator to pump water from our 120-meter-deep borehole across the farm to the pool in our caravan awning, running back and forth to check everything was filled up, then to turn it all off. And because it was nighttime, the water was icy cold. We had expected it to take 1 to 2 hours for him to take potfuls of water from the pool to boil and return before it would be warm enough for me to get into. We were very wrong. While he spent the next 5 hours boiling water, I was handling my contractions by kneeling on the floor of our caravan awning with my arms around the Swiss ball and a warm blanket draped over my back, still timing the contractions, which were continuing in their irregular pattern. Around 4 a.m. I began to wonder how much more of this I could handle, and definitely understood why people choose pain relief in birth. While the pain wasn't so completely unbearable, I found it so much more difficult not knowing how much longer I would need to endure it. Then I remembered that people usually start to experience these desperate thoughts around transition, and I perked up slightly to think, therefore, it wouldn't be too much longer to go. I vomited around this point, which really signified that it was in fact transition, which surprised me as I hadn't had any leaking water or signs of bloody show or mucus plug yet. Between 4:30 and 5 a.m, the contractions turned into urges to push, which I found to be a lot more bearable. I was still dressed and on the floor next to the pool at this point while my husband was still heating water. So I undressed, discovering that I had finally lost my mucus plug and had my husband bring me puppy pads to lay underneath me while I pushed on the floor. I believed pushing usually lasted a max of 1 to 2 hours, so I knew it couldn't be too much longer to go. I stopped timing the urges to push around 5 a.m, but they continued to come in an irregular pattern like the contractions had. I had been very determined not to tear, so I tried very carefully not to force any of the pushing urges. Around 6:30 a.m, the pool was finally warm enough for me to get into, and it felt heavenly. I had instructed my husband to massage my back and offer comforting words and encourage me to drink and relax my mouth muscles during this time, but it turns out I didn't want to be touched or to have any noise, so he was as helpful as he possibly could be to me by keeping the pool warm, staying quiet, and offering me a drink every few minutes. The only position I wanted to be in was on my knees, resting back on my ankles, head on the side of the pool. Unfortunately, I had already been on my knees for about 5 hours by this point, and my legs were going numb. I tried to stretch them out between each pushing phase, but I was very low on energy by now, and despite my husband's best efforts to encourage me to drink, I was probably getting a bit dehydrated. At some point during one of my pushes, I felt something pop out, and I knew it was too small to be the head. I was a bit scared to check, but when I did, I realized it was the amniotic sac beginning to bulge. I was relieved by now that something was finally happening, but after perhaps another hour with still just the sac continuing to bulge out further, I began to wonder if I should break it to speed things along. I had been wanting to leave it in the hope the baby would be born inside the amniotic sac, and was also worried I would no longer have the cushioning of the sac to ease the pain. I tried to squeeze it a couple of times and also tried gently tearing it between my fingernails, but with no success, so I decided to just leave it alone. I think around 8 a.m, when I had been pushing for about 3 hours, I finally began to feel the baby's head crowning. My husband reminded me I needed to relax, and I realized the stage was probably going so slowly because my legs were so numb. The pushing itself was tolerable, but doing it with numb legs meant I didn't feel very relaxed. I kept checking the head after the pushes and was feeling very discouraged with how slowly it was coming out. Finally, around 9 a.m, the head protruded a bit more, and after a few more involuntary pushes, I experienced that torturous burning ring of fire for about 30 seconds or so. I think this is the only time I cried out and made a sound all through labour, and it brought our Labrador and our Border Collie over to see the show. This is when I felt the whole head come out. It was only a matter of seconds before the rest of the body followed at 9:12 a.m. I had my energy back now and turned around to find our baby on the floor of the pool behind me. I pulled it to the surface and saw the cord was around its neck twice. It was tight enough that I couldn't just undrape it, but I held the baby up while my husband unwrapped it, and then we looked down and saw we had a boy. His eyes were open as soon as I pulled him out of the water, and he pinked up immediately. By the time we got around to doing the APGAR test, he had a perfect score of 10. He wasn't born inside the sac, so it must have ruptured just as he was coming out. We cuddled and breastfed in the pool for an hour before I desperately wanted to get out and dry off. We sat on the floor of the, caravan awning and burnt the cord, which ended up taking much longer than we anticipated, so eventually we ended up cutting it. And then we took him inside the caravan to be measured. Eventually I needed to use the toilet, which is when the placenta finally came out in one piece, 2.5 hours after the baby. My husband took this time to empty the pool and tidy everything up from the birth. The birth itself was perfect and everything I had hoped my unassisted birth would be. I had no tearing, and surprisingly, I didn't have any pain going to the toilet. The only issue I had was that I must have pinched a nerve in one of my legs because it was still numb 3 days later. This was at the time of writing the story. It did end up taking at least a month before I got the full feeling back in my leg. May have been 2 months actually, but it was gradually a little bit more each day. I would draw a mark on my leg to show where I could feel it. It was just my lower leg. Looking back over the birth, I realized I should have moved around more during active labor to prevent the numbness in my legs. And the only other thing we would do differently is to fill the pool up sooner. I realised that if I had given birth in a hospital or with some sort of medical attendant, I would have likely been subject to an induction since my contractions remained irregular. I probably would have been pushed to have a C-section since the second stage lasted so long. It's usually not allowed to last more than 2 hours, and mine lasted over 4.5. I would have been pressured to take something to encourage the placenta, even though that probably took so long because it was probably just stuck on my bladder, and I was a little scared mentally at the thought of pushing anything else out. And since our boy arrived at exactly 39 weeks, weighing 8 pounds, with no traces of vernix, I wonder if I had had a third trimester ultrasound, whether I would have been told he was going to be too big. So all of this really just solidified for me how glad I am that we decided to have an unassisted birth. I read a lot of birth affirmations leading up to this, but the only one that offered me any encouragement and really became my mantra throughout labour was, I can do anything for 60 seconds. So now I'll read out my second birth story. So once again, this was written in the days just after the birth. We live off-grid in a caravan on our farm in rural Portugal while rebuilding a stone ruin into a house. The day I went into labour, I woke up at 1 a.m. with insomnia. Unusually, my bed-sharing two-year-old also awoke, and we spent the next 3 hours cuddling together until sleep engulfed us again. He would lean in and kiss me every so often, wrapping his arms around my neck and whisper, "Hey, Mama." When we all awoke in the morning, my husband announced he was going to do some cleaning before the baby arrived. I teased him that he was nesting, cleaning windows, wiping down cupboards and door frames, the same thing I had done a month earlier, expecting the baby to arrive earlier like its big brother. We had a very relaxing, peaceful day. While my husband cleaned and fixed a broken door, my toddler and I did yoga and some laundry, drew some pictures, played with our new baby chicks, and made lunch. We were expecting visitors the next day, and the weather was supposed to be cooler. The loose dress I had taken to wearing in these final weeks wasn't going to cut it, so I played around trying to find clothes I could wear. My intolerance for underwear, waistbands, and fitted maternity clothes made this quite a challenge. Eventually, I settled on just wearing my husband's clothes. In the afternoon, my toddler played with my husband while I made us some mini donuts. We snacked on those and watched some nature documentaries. The lack of sleep the night before was beginning to take its toll. Afterwards, I did some dishes and put away the laundry, and as I finished up, I realised I'd had a few Braxton Hicks. Having experienced them every day for about 5 weeks, I'd gotten used to ignoring them. The only difference this time was that I was vaguely aware that there had been a few in a row. So at 6 p.m. I decided to start timing them just in case. My husband was outside with my son playing and doing various jobs. I set about cooking dinner. By 6:30 I'd had 5 contractions, 30 seconds long, 5 minutes apart. I went up to the house to get my labour aid drink out of the freezer. My husband and son were in there, and I held up the bottle to show my husband, just giving you a heads up. He set about getting things organised, pumping up the pool, flattening the ground where he was going to set it up, outside under an oak tree next to our hammock, setting a fire going in our fire pit just 2 metres away, and wrapping some fairy lights around the tree. My son and I ate some dinner. He was excited about the pool being set up and wanted to play in it, and wasn't happy when we stopped him. Instead, he played on the ground around it while I laid out all of my birth supplies and defrosted my labour aid drink. Then I played some music and we danced together for a while. Then we played with his cars until he announced that it was time for bed and milk. So it was about 8 p.m. now. Contractions had become strong enough that talking through them was becoming difficult. They were about 3 to 4 minutes apart. I put my son to bed, nursed him to sleep, and cuddled him a little longer than usual. When I went back outside, my husband set up his laptop for us to watch a movie. He had it on the table in our awning, and I was standing outside near the fire watching it, walking away each time I had a contraction to stare up at the stars. Around 9 p.m, when I'd just walked away for a contraction, my water broke, gushing out on the grass. I turned to my husband and we both laughed. I'd never experienced that before. It was a strange sensation. The fluid was clear. My husband gave me a towel to dry myself off, but I soon realized that was futile as the fluid continued to trickle out. I instructed my husband to begin filling up the pool now. I stood closer to the fire to keep warm while watching the movie, still walking away during each contraction. I'd liked that my water hadn't broken in labor with my son, as it meant there was no chance of a cord prolapse. Still, I reminded myself the chances were still very rare, considering I was pretty confident I was now in active labor. I continued standing by the fire, watching the movie, and walking away to stare up at the stars during each contraction. My husband was busy filling up the pool. He had tested it a month previously when he set up the piping to check the temperature and pressure of the water, but for reasons we still don't understand, the gas boiler kept cutting out this time, so filling the pool turned out to be a tougher job than he had anticipated. Eventually, he managed to get the pool about two-thirds full. He put a cover over it to keep it warm, and then he resorted to boiling pots of water over the fire and on the stove in the caravan to fill the remainder of the pool. A reminder from my first birth. Around 9:30, after another trickling of water, I decided to check it again, and that's when I noticed it was stained with dark meconium, meaning it was fresh. Knowing that in a medical capacity, this is usually taken as a sign of fetal distress, regardless of whether the fetus is actually in distress, I was relieved that I did not have any medical professionals in attendance to catastrophize the fresh meconium. Instead, I decided to use the fetoscope to listen to the heartbeat. I paid close attention, listening carefully for any abnormal variabilities, deceleration, tachycardia, etc. As I had thought, the heartbeat was strong, clear, and regular, and checking for the heart tone confirmed that the baby was still in the left occiput anterior position, as it had been for the past 2 weeks. I continued to feel regular fetal movements for the remainder of labour, signalling that the baby was still thriving. Now my only thing to be aware of was meconium aspiration. Knowing that the baby would be born in the water, I had very little concern about this, but I rehearsed in my head what I needed to do once the baby was born. In between filling up the pool and maintaining the fire, my husband also set up the spare bed in the caravan for himself and our toddler. It reminded me every so often to drink and to breathe. Labour continued to progress, and by about 10 p.m., I could no longer stand still in between contractions. Instead, I was now pacing back and forth in front of the caravan, in between them, and stopping to stare up at the stars during them. I began to make a sound that is best described as wailing like a ghost. I was visualizing my body opening up to let the baby out and reminding myself that I can do anything for 60 seconds. I closed the laptop at some point. I could no longer handle the stimulation of the sound and light from the movie. And then over the next half an hour, I hoped for transition, desperately wanting to reach that point where I wanted to give up. I really wanted to get into the water now, but I wanted to wait for transition when I would likely vomit like I did in my first birth before I got into the pool. I was finding it a challenge to walk through some of these contractions now, and I would kneel down on the ground while I waited for them to pass. At some point, while kneeling, I experienced a strange movement that briefly made me wonder if the baby had changed positions. It was such a fleeting thought, which I instantly dismissed, that I can't even remember exactly when this happened. After kneeling on the grass for several minutes, my husband asked if I would like my Swiss ball to lean on. I announced that I was getting in the pool now. I took off my dressing gown, dressed, and checked the time on my phone. 10:36. My husband helped me into the pool, and oh, the relief was instant. My husband later said he was so relieved at my reaction. He'd been worried that he couldn't get it warm enough. I relaxed so much that I'm sure I fell asleep for a few seconds, not long after I got in. I was concerned I'd gotten in too early because it seemed like a really long time without any contractions. I'd estimate maybe 10 minutes, considering they'd been only 2 minutes apart before I climbed in. I knew it was my body's way of letting me rest, so I embraced it. When they started back up, they were really intense, so strong, and then the end of it felt like a push. and I was confused as to whether I was in active labour or pushing. The next few contractions were the same, and I finally felt like I couldn't do it anymore. This was too hard. It was a satisfying realisation that I was in transition. My husband continued to offer me my drink and remind me to breathe. The fetal ejection reflex pushing became stronger, and I felt down for the head but couldn't feel anything yet. Around this time, my husband came and told me he thought I'd like to know that one of our cats was snuggled up against our sleeping son. As the pushing became stronger, I again felt for the head, but was surprised to find something soft. At first, it reminded me a little bit like the softness I'd felt when touching the amniotic sac with my first birth. But knowing my sac had already burst, I couldn't understand what it was. Perhaps it was the empty sac clinging to the baby's head. I wondered briefly if this wasn't actually part of the baby and was part of me that was swelling. I quickly dismissed this because nothing felt wrong. I was just going to continue allowing my body to do its thing. Still believing this was the head, I could feel it was going to come out very soon. In the next push, I felt it come out. I was about to call out to my husband, "The head's out," when I felt it and thought, "What is wrong with this head? It's soft and too small, and where's the neck?" A second later, the legs and arms tumbled out, and I realised I was holding the baby's bum. "It's a breech," I thought. And then, still in disbelief, I felt about again. "Yep, definitely breech." In the next 5 seconds, many things went through my head. I could feel to see if it's a boy or a girl. "No, that's not fair. Wait to find out with Nick. Besides, you have other things to think about." "I'll tell Nick it's breech." "Oh, but the instructions I left for him were to call our midwife friend if the baby is breech. But the whole body is already out, so she wouldn't get here in time. Besides, I don't have the time or energy to explain all of this to him. I know the head is going to come out quickly anyway, maybe in 2 to 3 pushes. Right now, my focus needs to be on letting go of any fear of tearing to allow my body to push this head out quickly." You know, all of these thoughts went through my head in about 5 seconds. And in that time, I went from kneeling upright against the edge of the pool to moving into the center of the pool, still upright in a half kneel, half squat position. My right hand still holding the baby's bum and my left hand feeling for the head. At the end of those 5 seconds, the head then came out quickly in one push, straight into my hands. Unlike with my son, I had caught this baby. "It's out," I called to my husband sitting 2 meters away next to the fire. He jumped up in surprise. He made to come over to me, then ran to get his phone for the light, pencil and paper from the awning. In the few seconds it took my husband to be at my side, I held the baby underwater to check for any cord entanglement. None. Then I deliberately brought the baby to the surface face down rather than face up like is recommended in water births, just to make sure that if there was any meconium on the baby's face, gravity would cause it to drop back down into the water rather than into its nose and mouth. And then I turned the baby towards me. No meconium on its face, and its eyes were open wide looking around. By the time the baby was on my chest, it was letting out a strong cry. Mouth and nostrils were clear, and any concerns regarding the meconium were gone. My husband was now at my side. On his way over, I had asked him what the time was. 11:08 p.m. It had taken 32 minutes from me getting in the pool to the baby being born. We did the Apgar test. With a score of 9, we decided not to bother retesting. "What is it? What is it?" my husband asked. "I don't know. Go and get our son." He was back quickly with our sleepy toddler. I held up the baby to see what it was. The umbilical cord was in the way, so I turned the baby over to look from behind. I stared confused, thinking, "What is wrong with this baby's penis?" At the same time, my husband's voice cries out next to me, "It's a girl!" Duh, of course, I thought. My husband put our grizzly toddler back to bed, and for the next hour he maintained the heat in the pool for us and updated our relatives back home. The baby nursed hungrily. Unlike her brother, who had been content to just be cuddled, she continued to cry unless she was latched on. After about an hour, we got out of the pool, all wrapped up in towels and blankets, and sat on our outdoor couch near the fire. Our plan had been to burn the cord like we had with our son. But since she needed to nurse, we found it awkward to access a clear piece of the cord to burn while we were all wrapped up in towels and blankets. So my husband sterilised our scissors and he cut it instead. Then we weighed and measured her, 8 pounds, 3 ounces. 51 centimetres long and a 35 centimetre head, the exact same head size as her brother, which had taken 4.5 hours of fetal ejection reflex pushing to get out. I snuggled up on the couch with the baby for maybe another hour, waiting for the placenta. Eventually, I passed the baby to my husband while I went to empty my bladder to see if that would encourage the placenta along like it had after my first birth. Meanwhile, the baby continued to cry strongly, upset that we had stopped nursing. I had no success with the placenta. My husband and I were tired now and wanted to go to bed. I accidentally woke my toddler when I was preparing the bed to get in. So while my husband held a still crying baby, I nursed a grisly toddler back to sleep. Eventually, I climbed into bed with both babies, but with a still nursing newborn and a toddler who continued to wake up, unhappy that I wasn't rolling over to cuddle him, I wasn't getting to sleep anytime soon. Over the next couple of hours, I went to empty my bladder a couple more times, hoping for the placenta to fall out. But each time I either had a crying newborn or a crying toddler in the background. So after my third attempt, I realised that the placenta was not going to come out until I was totally relaxed, and that meant I needed to wait until both children were settled. My husband ended up taking our son into the spare bed he had made up for them, and around 4 a.m, once the baby had finally stopped nursing and fallen asleep, I was able to empty my bladder again, and this time the placenta came out nearly 5 hours after the baby was born. It looked whole to me, but I was tired and couldn't be bothered checking it thoroughly. I left it until the morning, and when I checked it over, it was perfectly intact. Once again, I experienced a free birth without any tearing, and once again, it was a birth that would have occurred with multiple unnecessary interventions had I had a medical professional present. The fresh meconium, the breech baby, and the 5 hours for the placenta would have all been considered complications. Now, if you only listen to the podcast and haven't followed me on social media, these are probably the only two birth stories you're expecting, but not quite finished yet. Back in January of 2021, the kids and I were walking home from the beach when I wiped my hand across my nose and noticed a streak of blood on it. And that's when I realised I was pregnant again. Unlike a lot of people who suffer from morning sickness in pregnancy, my most persistent symptom is a stuffy nose that sporadically bleeds, and later on, insomnia. It was another 2 weeks of living in a state of contained excitement before I finally took a test to confirm what I already knew. I enjoyed those 2 weeks of Schrodinger's cat-like knowledge, both knowing and not knowing at the same time. The day after taking the test was the 13-year anniversary of when my husband and I began dating. And so this is when I shared it with my husband by writing on my kids' bellies, on my daughter's, I wrote, youngest child expiry, with the due date of this next child. And on my son's, I just wrote, happy 13-year anniversary. It took us a little while to adjust to the idea of another child. It was a surprise baby, and we didn't have a permanent living situation at the time. And my daughter at 2.5 was still needed me a lot more than her brother had when he was 2.5. But, you know, we knew we could make it work, even if the timing wasn't ideal. And then when I was 8 weeks pregnant, the kids and I were in the city running errands, overnighting at my parents' house. My dad was out of town and my son was sleeping in my mum's bed. I woke up at 5 a.m, snuggled up to my sleeping daughter, and as I rolled over, I realised I was lying in a pool of blood. I knew immediately that I was miscarrying. As with my births, I switched off my limbic system, i.e. I didn't allow myself to feel any emotion and became very focused on how to handle the situation for the coming day. You know, not wanting to wake my daughter and still being tired, I soon fell back to sleep. I was woken not long after 7 when my son crawled into bed with us. My mum had left the house to go for a run. My daughter then woke, desperately asking to go to the toilet, and I reluctantly got out of bed to follow her, reluctantly because I knew I was going to have to deal with this whole situation. And once she'd finished, it was my turn, and I immediately felt the embryo and everything pass. To lighten the mood, my son then ran past saying he desperately needed the toilet, so I sent him down to the other one down the hallway. At that point, I felt like I was going to vomit and faint at the same time. I asked my two-year-old to run and get my phone. This could have gone two ways. She was equally likely to get distracted, but bless her, she returned swiftly with it, and I phoned my mum to come back home and help. Meanwhile, my daughter was pointing at the blood on the floor and asking if I have an owie foot, and my son is yelling down the hallway that he's finished on the toilet. So 3 hours later, still with my emotions suppressed so I can be focused, I was cleaned up, fed, watered, courtesy of my mum, and the kids and I drove the 1.5 hours back to my husband, where I spent the next 1 to 2 weeks recovering. This is a traumatic thing that happened, similar in a way that the 5 car accidents I was in 10 years ago were traumatic, but I openly shared those with other people. With a miscarriage, I want everyone to know because it has permanently changed me in unexplainable ways, but at the same time, I don't want to make other people uncomfortable by sharing it. Besides, you don't really know how to bring it up in a casual conversation. It was interesting to experience it in that I learned how a miscarriage feels very, very similar to labour and birth, and afterwards you feel very similar to postpartum. But what was surprising to me was that I still felt pregnant after I'd miscarried, and I still continued to test positive for, I'm pretty sure it was over 2 weeks I was still testing positive, and I began to wonder if I had been pregnant with twins and had just miscarried one of them, but by 3 weeks the pregnancy tests were finally coming back negative.
In retrospect, I was okay with losing the baby. I saw it as a natural way for my body to remove this little being that was probably incompatible with life. The only part I found really hard was that it disappeared down the toilet when it passed, and I never got to see or hold that tiny person.
But yes, that is my third birth story. Now I do have another one to share here.
As you have probably guessed by now from these background noises you can hear.
Now, after our first two children were born on our off-grid farm in Portugal, attended by just myself and my husband. We moved back to New Zealand in July of 2019 with the intention of finding land to live off-grid again. This took considerably longer than we'd anticipated, and it was over 3 years before we finally moved onto our new land with our 6.5-year-old, almost 4-year-old, and I was 33 weeks into my fourth pregnancy. So a quick backstory, halfway through that period of limbo when we were looking for land, I had experienced an unexpected pregnancy followed by an unexpected miscarriage. Well, all miscarriages are probably unexpected, at 8 weeks. I'm clarifying this because out of all 4 pregnancies, this 4th one was my hardest. Compared to most people, it probably wasn't that challenging since I haven't experienced morning sickness in any of my pregnancies. But what I really struggled with was fatigue. And when I mentioned this to other people, they would just say, but you have 2 older children to take care of now. That's why you're tired. But I still had those 2 children in my short-lived 3rd pregnancy, and they were younger and therefore busier, and I was still breastfeeding both of them in that 3rd pregnancy. But for both of my first 2 pregnancies, I experienced about 2 to 3 weeks of extreme fatigue in the first trimester, which coincided with the growth of the placenta and therefore naturally lower blood pressure and blood sugar levels. And then after that brief period of fatigue, my energy was essentially normal again for the rest of the pregnancies. I didn't reach this point of fatigue in my 3rd pregnancy, but in my 4th it started early, much earlier, at 5 weeks, and it lasted until 17 weeks when I decided to try taking 100% grass-fed beef liver capsules. It also helped considerably with the immense hunger I had been feeling too. This surprised me greatly because nutritionally I had carefully prepared my body for pregnancy for over 2 years leading up to this. And this, combined with discovering I had a gluten intolerance after the birth of my first 2 children and consequently followed a gluten-free diet which had permanently boosted my energy levels, I had been expecting more energy this time around, not less. Not to mention we ate liver in our food every couple of weeks, as well as consumed it in the form of pate at least once a week. It made me think I was already getting more than sufficient nutrients. Halfway through this latest pregnancy, my son had said to me that he hoped I didn't die when I had the baby. I told him I would be fine. I didn't die when I had him and his sister. But this inevitably wore away at me for the rest of my pregnancy. Initially, I put it down to some anxiety after experiencing the miscarriage. But when I spoke to others who'd also experienced healthy pregnancies following miscarriages, they all agreed that experienced this increased anxiety, but that it went away once they'd passed the gestation when they'd miscarried, or once they felt the baby start to move. And it dawned on me that I didn't actually have any concerns about the baby. I felt confident that the baby would be well and healthy. My concern was that, well, any pregnant woman has an increased risk of death. I actually had zero concerns for the common maternal complications like hemorrhaging, placental abruption, preeclampsia, cholestasis, gestational diabetes, etc., because I was super strict with monitoring myself and my nutrition and movements. I'd had some varicose veins removed a couple of months before falling pregnant this time, as they had caused some issues in my third pregnancy, and so I had them removed to prevent any chance of blood clots. And I was aware of the location of the placenta, but despite eliminating all of these concerns, you know, a healthy mother can still die, for example, of an amniotic fluid embolism, which, while incredibly rare, can cause almost instant death, regardless of where the mother is giving birth. Knowing how rare it was, it never concerned me in my previous pregnancies, but I think it gnawed away at me because I'd promised my son I wouldn't die, and that isn't something I could actually guarantee despite doing everything right. There is still a possibility of death. I even briefly considered hiring a midwife, but ultimately I decided against that because I knew it was far more likely that a midwife would encourage interventions due to perceived complications rather than the likelihood of me experiencing an amniotic fluid embolism.
Not that a midwife would be able to keep me alive in that eventuality anyway.
So I began to feel regular practice contractions in the evenings from around 34, 35 weeks and wondered if the baby may come early. I was really in two minds here since my first child came at 39 weeks and my second child came after 41 weeks. There was a full moon 2 days after I reached 37 weeks and I had pretty consistent practice contractions for about 24 hours. There were still many things I wanted to do before birth and I was trying to mentally prepare myself for all the plans I would have to abandon. And my husband spent that day trying to sort out piping for the pool, which he had thought he still had some time to organise. But it turned out it was a false alarm. I didn't mind these practice contractions. I'd experienced many when I was pregnant with my daughter, and it had led to a tolerably short 5-hour labour, which I was anticipating again this time around. The day after I reached 38 weeks, we had an early fourth birthday celebration for my daughter. We had 11 extra kids and 5 extra adults over for the afternoon. And halfway through the party, I realised that the baby had dropped and I was finding walking that little bit more challenging. We all half joked that I'd probably end up having the baby that evening. I was still hoping the baby would stay in for at least another week as there were small things I wanted to do. The next day was Saturday and I baked some cookies and bread for the freezer. My husband took some maternity photos of the kids and I in our river. He also announced that I could finally use the washing machine, having not had it set up since we'd moved into the house. When I woke on the Sunday, not in labour, I was going to spend the day doing laundry, all our bedding, towels, clothes, etc., some more baking for the freezer and some cleaning. And knowing I was going to achieve all of that, I finally felt mentally ready to give birth. And surprisingly, I also woke up that morning with all that anxiety around an amniotic fluid embolism just gone, and I was finally excited for labour and birth. As it was, on the Tuesday afternoon, I had a pregnancy massage, which was so relaxing, and I thought for sure I would be so relaxed I'd go into labour that night. I was so excited about the prospect of labour and birth the whole drive home, but I woke up Wednesday morning at 38 weeks and 6 days, the same gestation when labour had begun with my first child, and was relieved I could still do all my Wednesday things. Yeah, living rurally, Wednesday is our busy town day. I prepare all our food and pack everything we need for the day on the Tuesday. So on this particular Wednesday, I got up, lit our fire, fed our lambs, cooked breakfast, did my son's mathematics work with him, and did some yoga. It was while I was doing yoga that I had a practiced contraction that made me pause. I tried continuing with yoga but had another practiced contraction, so I decided to end yoga for the day and do one of my spinning babies exercises, a forward-leaning inversion. And once again, I had another practice contraction. Being all packed and ready for the day, I decided not to try any more restorative exercises, and we set out for our day. I did give my husband a heads up that we may end up coming home early, as I'd had three practice contractions. We left the house around 9 a.m. We did my son's reading and writing work in the car, made a brief stop to pick up dog food and shoes for my son, who was entered into a duathlon that coming weekend. So I was still hoping the baby would stay in long enough for me to watch him participate in that. Then we had my daughter's swimming lesson for half an hour, picked up some of the toys and crafts for our homeschooling group from the house of someone who wasn't attending that day, stopped by the dump to dispose of our rubbish and recycling, and then we spent the next few hours with our homeschooling group. In that time, one of the parents told me about a free house cow with a newborn calf we could have. And at the same time, my husband phoned to say he'd gotten a new job that he had been waiting to hear back about for some weeks. His company had let go most of their staff the day we had picked up the keys to our new land. So this was so much wonderful news to receive all at once. We ended up leaving our homeschool group later than intended. And by the time we stopped by the supermarket to collect our groceries, a department store to collect a couple of small things, the pharmacy to stock up on supplies, the hardware store to get something for my husband and put petrol in the car, I'd realised we weren't going to have time for a play swim before my son's swimming lesson at 4. The kids were very disappointed, so I said we could maybe have a play swim after his lesson. As it was, I'd had a few more practice contractions during these errands and was wondering if we should aim to get home sooner rather than later. At the pool, we discovered that the playing pool was closed anyway, likely due to a code brown. So I told the kids we'd have to miss out on a play swim today. My daughter was very disappointed. She wanted us to go in the toddler pool after my son's lesson, which is just ankle-deep water. But I experienced a handful of contractions during my son's half-hour lesson, so I said we were going to have to go home because my body was getting ready to have the baby. My daughter was not happy. It's probably the most grumpy she has ever been at me, and she refused to engage with me for the entire drive home. And so in the car at about 5 p.m. I began roughly timing my contractions to see how far apart they were. They were about 7 to 8 minutes apart, not very strong, but I was clearly able to tell when they started and stopped. My husband was across the river with our dogs when we arrived home, so my son took off to see them while my daughter continued to sulk in the car despite my gentle words of attempted engagement. I unpacked everything from our day of errands. I was feeling very rushed, like I wanted to get everything put away before my contractions got stronger. My husband came in when I was halfway through putting away the groceries, and I let him know that I wouldn't be surprised if the baby arrived that evening. We put everything else away together. I asked him to bring in one of my bottles of homemade Labor Aid from the garage freezer to defrost, and I cooked up dinner. He coaxed my daughter in from the car, but it was still a while before she finally engaged with me. I think it was around 6 or 7 when I decided to start properly timing the contractions on my phone. They were about 5 minutes apart and 30-ish seconds long, but not too strong. I did some hip opening exercises on my Swiss ball for a while. My husband and I were trying to work out if we should set everything up for birth or not. And then we put the kids to bed around 8 p.m. I lay and cuddled in between them, realizing that this could be the last time I cuddled the two of them to sleep for a while. My son was very excited that the baby was going to be coming soon. It made us promise that we would wake them both up in the night so they could see the baby being born. I stayed up for another hour, expecting the contractions to increase in length and strength. But by 9 p.m, despite the contractions being consistent in time, they weren't getting any stronger. And I was finally very sleepy after our big day, so I lay down next to my daughter and fell asleep. The contractions continued throughout the night, although when I lay down they were only about 10 to 20 minutes apart. I think I managed to sleep about 4 straight hours. My contractions just strong enough to seep into my dreams, but not enough to wake me up. Around 1 or 2 a.m. I got up feeling very hungry and thirsty, so I boiled a couple of eggs, ate a few pieces of toast, drank a couple of cups of milk with cream, and kept the fire going and began sipping on the Laborade. I monitored my blood pressure and checked the baby's heart rate and position, and did a few spinning babies exercises, hip opening exercises on the Swiss ball, and did some things on my laptop. Around 3 or 4 a.m., I was feeling sleepy again, and the contractions hadn't increased in severity, so I decided to go back to bed. I think everyone woke up around 7 a.m., and I told my husband I'd still been having contractions all night. He and the kids got up. He asked if I wanted breakfast, but after my snack in the night, I wasn't hungry. I lay in bed for a couple of hours, half dozing, half watching Netflix on my laptop, continuing to time my contractions. If I got up and moved about, my contractions were only about 3 minutes apart and between 30 to 60 seconds long. But if I lay down to rest, they were 10 minutes apart and at least a minute longer and stronger than the ones I was experiencing from moving about. Around 9 a.m., I realized this labor had officially become my longest one yet. I got up and did some more exercises on my Swiss ball and then decided to walk about outside. It was a beautiful sunny day, and I created an L-shaped path that I stuck to, pacing backwards and forwards, the dogs following me to and fro. I loved that so much, as they had done the exact same thing when I was in labor with my daughter 4 years earlier. Each time I stopped to have a contraction, I'd look around me, whether it was at the lambs sleeping in the meadow, the sunlight shining through the spring leaves of the giant poplars, the river flowing at their roots, or the kids playing around the trampoline. Also, the neighbours across the road were moving that day, so there were trucks and cars coming and going, so I watched them as a distraction, amused that life was continuing as normal for other people. Meanwhile, the kids were mostly keeping to themselves, or with my husband. Every so often they would come and tell me something completely unrelated to me being in labour, like my son telling me about a monster he'd drawn, or my daughter giving me a flower she'd picked. Each time my son wanted to talk to me, it seemed to be just after a contraction ended, and I was clear-headed enough to interact with him. Whereas I felt so guilty because it seemed like every time my daughter wanted to talk to me, it was just as a contraction was starting and I'd have to put my hand up to ask her to wait, and she'd run away. After pacing for an hour or so, the contractions were building in intensity, still regularly 3 minutes apart and about 40 seconds long. I was beginning to make a ghost-like wail during them, but once they were over, I was clear-headed again. I decided to go inside and rest on my side again. I monitored my blood pressure again and checked the baby's heart rate and position again with the fetoscope. Then I watched a little bit of Netflix and managed to doze for about half an hour. But the contractions when I was lying down were so strong. While they were 7 to 10 minutes apart, they lasted up to 2 minutes long and had about three peaks in them. So I got up again, and this time I set up some Bob Dylan songs to play on my phone and put my headphones in and resumed pacing outside again. And once again, the contractions were about 3 minutes apart and 40 seconds long. I think it was around 1:30 p.m. that I suggested to my husband that he begin filling up the pool. I was still very uncertain with how much I was progressing. I hadn't lost any of my mucus plug, my water was still intact, and I could think clearly in between contractions. So I was still hesitant that birth could potentially be another 12 hours or so away, and I was reluctant for my husband to use up all of our hot water in the pool and then have it go cold by the time I was ready to give birth. But I was so sick of pacing and so sick of the horribly long contractions I was getting when I lay down on my side to rest. I just wanted to do something different. I originally wanted to give birth outside like I had with my first two, but the daylight was a distraction, and despite living rurally, the few cars and moving trucks that would go past could see me, and there was a very slight breeze that I wanted to avoid. So we decided to set up the pool inside in front of our fire. He filled the pool up pretty quickly. The kids were very eager to help. He had some music playing, and so I set it up to play Bob Dylan for us to all listen to. And I paced around the pool for about half an hour, still not convinced if it was time to get in. With my first two births, once I got in the pool, I didn't get out again until after birth. I was surprisingly okay with the kids chatting and playing and dancing around me. I found it slightly challenging if they tried to talk to me, but my husband was good at distracting them, and they were old enough to understand I needed space. My son especially took to watching me quietly and curiously from a distance, as though I was some sort of unpredictable creature. After listening to Bob Dylan for a while, my husband put on an 80s playlist, which I really loved. I made the decision to get in the pool, but forced myself to do a few spinning babies exercises first. The baby was in the optimal left occiput anterior position and had been for many weeks leading up to birth and hadn't changed at all during labour, but the length of labour was having me go through all the potential causes for it being prolonged, malpositioning being one of them. So after I did the exercises as a precaution, I finally got in the pool around 2 p.m. and it was so, so lovely, but my body reacted to being in the pool the same way it did to resting. The contractions were felt further apart, about 10 minutes, and very strong, well over a minute long. After about half an hour of this, I wanted to do something different, so I got up and went to the toilet. Immediately, the contractions became closer together and shorter again. I got back in the pool for another half an hour or so, and being sick of the horribly long contractions, I got out and rested on my side on the bed in a half doze. I was so, so sick of being in labour. I'd been carrying around a bowl with me for the past hour or so because I felt slightly nauseous and was really hoping I would vomit soon as a sign I was in transition, but still I hadn't lost any mucus plug. My water was still intact and I could still think very clearly in between contractions. I went to the toilet again and then lay down on the bed for about another half an hour, trying to work out if I could tolerate the half-hour drive to hospital and what they could give me to rest for a little bit because I was just so sick of these contractions. But there was no way I wanted to drive in labour. My husband poked his head in the door briefly to see how I was. I told him I was so sick of how long it was taking. He looked really sympathetic and asked if it was okay though. I said everything was fine, nothing was wrong, I just wished labour could be over. So I decided to get up to go outside and pace again, but I had barely reached the bedroom door when a contraction struck that felt a little bit pushy. So I switched course and made a mad dash in this end labour state towards the pool and half threw myself in the pool just as the pushy contraction reached its peak. I then had a couple of minutes of rest in the water before I felt a true fetal ejection reflex push beginning. I felt the mucus plug detach and reached down with my hand to feel the squishiness of the amniotic sac before that burst, with the head beginning to come through. I was so overlaboured that I was determined the entire head was coming out in this push, and so it did. I immediately called out to my husband and the kids who were sitting quietly a couple of metres away that the head was out. They all rushed over to the pool, and I felt the body slide out. I started to pick the baby up and realised a leg was still inside me, so I waited another second or two for that to come out, and then pulled the baby straight up towards me, though the cord was quite short, so I leaned back with the baby against my belly. I heard exclamations from my kids that it was smaller than they expected, and why was it that bluish colour? My husband had grabbed the paper to do an Apgar test, but we didn't bother with it. The baby had let out a clear cry immediately. Its reflexes were strong. Its face was animated with expression, mostly grimacing, and while it was a bit bluish, I had no concerns and explained to my kids it was because half of its blood was still in the placenta and it would pink up soon, which it did. My husband checked the time, 4:15 p.m. I considered active labour to have begun around roughly 5 p.m. the evening before, so almost 24 hours of labour. The baby was clearly tired too after such long labour, slowly blinking its eyes as though it was really sleepy, and letting out the occasional cries, but if anything, you know, brushed its feet, like my arm or my daughter's hand, the entire leg jerked. The cord was just long enough that the baby's head could reach my nipple. I felt a warmth and said, "Oh, the baby's done wheeze." And we were all saying, "We don't even know if it's a boy or a girl yet." You see, when I was pregnant with my first child, I was certain he was a girl. And obviously he turned out to be a boy. When I was pregnant with my second child, I was certain she was a boy, and she turned out to be a girl. This time, I was far more certain that I was having another boy. Very early in my pregnancy, before I even knew I was pregnant, I had felt this strange male presence right next to me, and so I decided if I turn out to be pregnant, it's certainly a boy. And I had never experienced that before, and haven't experienced it again. But yeah, while my first two guesses were just guesses, this time I was certain. But the cord was too short for me to lift up to check. After a couple of minutes, I tried changing positions to lift and see past the umbilical cord. I wasn't sure I could see a penis, so I said, I think I'm wrong again, since, you know, I had been so 100% convinced it was a boy. So I held it up again for my husband to check, and he said, yes, it's a girl. So, yep, wrong three times. I was a little cold and shivery, so I had my husband top the pool up with warmer water, and it was so luxurious. My daughter had wanted to join me in the water since I had told her she could after the baby was born, but the water was all murky from the mucus plug. I had lost my plug prior to getting in the pool with my first two, so I hadn't anticipated that it would cloud the water so much. We still had the 80s music playing, and the kids sat next to the pool looking at the baby and asking questions. My husband let our Labrador in, and he came in eagerly and licked the baby's head. She finally showed an interest in nursing after about half an hour. And then an hour after that, I decided to get out. My husband helped me out of the pool. He had set up some waterproof blankets and towels on one of our beanbags. And as I sat down, it felt like the placenta had started to come out, so I squatted over the metal bowl for about 5 minutes, but nothing came out. So I relaxed on the beanbag while my husband emptied the pool. My plan was then to have the kids burn the cord. They had a candle each and were waiting eagerly. But in the end, we decided to cut it because it was just so short. There was very little slack to easily burn it. My husband sterilized the scissors and cut the cord. Then I wrapped up the baby and handed it to my husband. I took the metal bowl with me to the toilet. And as I emptied my bladder, the placenta came out 2.5 hours after the baby. I had to pull the placenta out of the toilet, and the suction of the toilet meant that as I did so, one of my fingers tore through it. But apart from that single tear, the rest of the placenta was complete. We saved it in the garage fridge and planted a young oak tree on it, on top of it 4 days later. I washed myself off and got all comfortably wrapped up in my dressing gown, and then the kids helped me weigh the baby, 3.44 kilograms, 7 pounds 9 ounces. My lightest baby and my longest labour, I didn't measure her until the next day, a 34 centimetre head and 50 centimetres long. Once again, both measurements smaller than both of her older siblings. It was a different experience to have given birth during the daylight. I wonder if the light was what had kept me so clear-headed and lucid in between the later contractions. It was so much easier to withdraw inside myself in the darkness of night during my first two births. If I'd known I was so close to the end this time, I would have found it much more bearable. As with my previous two births, I'm very pleased we did not have a medical attendant, as I likely would have been subject to unnecessary interventions due to perceived complications, namely the prolonged active labour. The roughly acceptable time frame for this is about 20 hours for a first birth and 8 to 10 hours for subsequent births. They likely would have swept my membranes to encourage out the mucus plug or broken my waters or given me Pitocin to augment my labour. And also the 2.5 hour wait for the placenta. Pretty typical for me since my first was also a 2.5 hour wait and my second was a 5 hour wait. All variations of normal. While people generally believe that the placenta normally comes out straight away, depending on where a person gives birth, there is about a 99% chance that the medical attendants inject the mother the moment the baby is born to encourage the placenta to come out straight away, which is why that is so often seen as the norm. Now, at the time of recording this, my youngest daughter, my newest daughter, is now 5 weeks old, and this is my third time in postpartum, and there's a few things I've learned. I'd forgotten about waking up in huge puddles of milk every morning. Fortunately, I recall this eases around 8 weeks. After my second child, I remember feeling so frustrated at the lack of natural movement from resting in reclined or poor posture positions after being so strict all pregnancy. This time I'm giving myself grace. It's better not to rush my body. At some point, I'll regularly start doing yoga and restorative exercises again. Also, it is said that breastfeeding is not supposed to hurt. This has not been my experience for the first couple of weeks after every birth. And I know it's not the baby's latch because it hurt this time when my almost 4-year-old latched on too. just like it did last time when her brother latched on when she was a newborn. And both of them had had years of pain-free experience with breastfeeding. Hormones are fun. Also, newborns get angry very quickly. I'd forgotten about that. It'll be different for everybody, but it takes me 8 weeks for my new normal life routine to be established. And trying to rush that helps no one.
And another one is that I feel so unsettled if anyone else holds my newborn, except for my husband and kids. I couldn't quite put my finger on the reason for this. I always figured it was a combination of the person wearing clothing, which prevented them from being skin to skin with the infant, and that they weren't lactating, so they couldn't provide my baby with the breast milk it needed so frequently, or that my naked baby might wee or poo on them, forcing me to then apologise because their clothes have gotten soiled because they don't understand elimination communication and don't know the baby's cues. Yet when I interviewed Dr. Oscar Serilac, he explained that it can be very stressful for a mother for someone else to be holding the baby, and it's not a conscious thing that the mother's deciding. What people don't realise is the placenta gets a lot of the addiction pathways activated in terms of maternal behaviour. So that explains why I don't want that baby leaving my arms in those first couple of weeks. But once the baby is a little older, I'm gradually more okay with others holding him or her.
And being around other people, other than my husband and kids, literally doing nothing but sitting and holding my baby, exhausts me. Mostly it's the mental focus to follow a conversation, but also being around others while trying to breastfeed a newborn who was still figuring out how to nurse while wearing respectable clothes when all I want is to be topless just to make it easier. I remember with my son maybe twice having some visitors and attending a barbecue in those first, in those first 2 months, and I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to prepare anything. I literally just sat there and chatted with people, enjoyed the company. But, oh my goodness, the exhaustion. It set me back it was about a week before I was back to how I had been before I attended that. And this time with my newest child, her sister turned 4 3 weeks after she was born. And I'd really wanted to make it special for my daughter. So we had a little party, just family, people I was happy to be around, but I knew I was pushing it to do it when I was only 3 weeks postpartum. So I stressed the whole week leading up to it, wondering how I was going to cope. And once again, I enjoyed myself and I didn't have to do anything. Everybody else, you know, helped me and tended to me. Had a wonderful time chatting with everybody, but the next 3 days I felt more exhausted than I had after giving birth. It was a complete brain fog, so hard to concentrate, just walking around in a daze, just walking a couple of steps, I'd just want to lie down.
It was like a bone deep exhaustion where my whole body screamed at me to stop moving and rest, all just from socializing for a few hours.
And I ended up developing a clogged milk duct, which in the past I've only ever developed when I've pushed myself too much. So yeah, once again, I pushed myself, but I knew I was pushing myself, but I wanted to do it for my daughter. And I did the same thing a week later for my son. He was attending a sports event. I was 4 weeks postpartum then. And so I had a wonderful time seeing all the other mums that I hadn't seen for a few weeks. And then the next 2 days, I was just absolutely shattered. But then if I don't go anywhere or do anything or see anyone, it's essentially normal life around here. I'm able to take care of the baby. I'm able to homeschool my son. I'm able to cook the meals and do the dishes and do the laundry. But yeah, if I see people, takes me right back. I guess a lot of people don't quite understand that, and that's why I loved my interview with Oscar Serilac, where he said it's so, so important to give mothers space and to be firm on setting those sort of boundaries of not opening up the doors until the mother is ready. because it's not just me that's sacrificing. By taking the energy away from me, I'm not able to give enough to, well, the baby, but more so my other children. So it's like a sacrifice to them if I'm just trying to socialize. Anyway, I had a lot more I wanted to share in this episode, so I'm going to have to make this into two parts. I will release the second part in the next episode. Oh, another thing is the witching hour. I'd forgotten about how challenging the witching hour is. And it's not just 1 hour. Usually it's like 3 or 4 hours in the evening, between about 4 and 8, when the baby is just constantly wanting to either nurse or nap or be held. And none of my kids have liked to be in a wrap at that point. They literally want to be in my arms, which is very challenging when you're very hungry and wanting to make dinner, or trying to get the laundry sorted so you've got nappies for the nighttime, or trying to do the dishes so you can actually cook a meal. But yes, I'd forgotten about that. And I've just recently remembered that with my daughter, with my second child, I didn't go anywhere at nighttime for her first year. Sure, I really reduced that socializing for the first 8 weeks. And then afterwards, I'd be happy to attend things during the day, but did not go anywhere at nighttime.
It just wasn't worth it. The night out certainly wouldn't be enjoyable for me. And with a baby who just wanted to cluster feed and not stay still, our presence wasn't going to make it more enjoyable for the others. But I must say, I love having older kids this time around. I really understand why 4 years is the average age gap between siblings in Indigenous societies. Not only has the older child received at least 2 or 3 years of breast milk, and the mother's body has replenished itself from the previous birth, but the child is old enough to have a greater awareness, understanding, and helpfulness. My kids fill up my water bottle and bring it to me without being asked, empty the baby's potty, bring me food, make me snacks, as long as it means they can have some too, of course, take away my empty plate, put things in the washing machine, hold the baby so I can go to the toilet. In fact, at the moment, we've started a little routine where my daughter wears the baby in a wrap in the morning so I can hang out the washing and do the breakfast dishes, and then my son wears the baby in the evening so I can get dinner sorted and do the lunch dishes. I hope this continues for a long time, though it may get challenging the heavier the baby gets. I should say, though, that my biggest challenge has not been trying to give enough attention to each individual child like I had expected. Instead, it's been trying to protect the baby from her sister's magnetic love. There's a lot of rigorous patting, fast movements right in her face, loudly saying hello right in her ears, pouncing on her when her eyes flicker in her sleep because she thinks the baby's awake, kissing her and patting her when she's asleep, and picking her up as carefully as a 4-year-old can. So since this episode has actually ended up being much longer than I intended, I will split it into two parts. In the second part, I will share why I chose to free birth my kids, what my self-directed prenatal care looked like, my elimination communication practices, also known as diaper-free or nappy-free, and why I chose to homeschool my kids. And now that I have 3 children, I have chosen to end this podcast. It has taken far more time to put together than I ever anticipated, and I really need that time now so I can continue to implement all of these practices that I've shared on here over the past 4 years with all 3 of my kids. I tried to cover a lot of ground in this final season, all the topics that I hadn't quite gotten around to. There were a couple of people that I really wanted to interview, but for various reasons that didn't pan out, so I will be sharing some of their knowledge in the next part by reading out some of their work. Hopefully I can make the next part shorter than this part. Thanks for listening to these birth stories.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.